November day where, if you were at home, you'd be eating earth-toned soups in a warm kitchen, listening to the wind, and glad of home and hearth. Every year himself came was the same. The deciduous trees were always skeletal, the pines palsied, the willows wind-whipped and nubbly, the grass dun and crunchy underfoot, the water rats always seeing the big drainage picture first and gliding like night to the cement sides to flee. Always a crowd in thickening rings, always rollerblades on the garden's paths, lovers joined at the hand, frisbee in the distance on the rim of the garden's other side's hillside's slope, which faces away from the pond. U.S. Office of Unspecified Services Chief Rodney Tyne stands at the unclean window for much of the morning, ruminative, his posture a marshal at ease. A stenographer and an aide and a deputy mayor and the director of the Massachusetts Division for Substance Abuse Services and Unspecified Services Regional Operatives Rodney Tyne Jr.
257
and Hugh Steepley
258
all sit silently in the conference room behind him, the stenographer's Greg pen poised in mid-dictation. The eighth-floor window's purview goes all the way to the ridge of the hillside at the garden's other end. Two frisbees and what looks like a disemboweled ring of frisbee float back and forth along this ridge, dreamily floating back and forth, sometimes dipping below the ridge and lost for a moment to the specular vision of Tyne. Trying at the same time to give his bad skin some quality UV and a good chills chap, the grad work-study engineer of MIT's WYYY-109 lies bare-chested on a silvery NASA souvenir space blanket, supine, and cruciform, at about the angle of a living room recliner on the public garden's far hillside. This is out by Arlington Street, in the garden's southwest corner, hidden by its ridge from the pond's basin, and tourism booth, and pavilion, and the hub of radial paths, and the giant verdigrised statues of ducklings in a row, commemorating Robert McCloskey's beloved and timeless Make Way for Ducklings. The garden's only other slope is now the bowl of the former pond. The hillside's grassy decline, not too steep, runs at a wedge's angle down toward Arlington Street and is one broad greensward, free of dog droppings because dogs won't go to the bathroom on inclined terrain. Frisbees float on the ridge behind the engineer's head, and four lithe boys on the ridge play a game with a small beanbaggy ball and bare blue feet. It is 5 degrees Celsius. The sun has the attenuated autumn quality of seeming to be behind several panes of glass. The wind is bitter and keeps flopping unmoored sections of NASA blanket over parts of the engineer's body. Goose pimples and real pimples jostle each other for space on his exposed flesh. The student engineer's is the hillside's only metallic space blanket and bare torso. He lies there, splayed, wholly open to the weak sun. The WYYY student engineer is one of roughly 3 dozen human forms scattered over the steep slope, a human collection without pattern or cohesion or anything to bind them, looking rather like firewood before it's been gathered. Wind-bronzed sooty men in zipperless parkas and mismatched shoes, some of the garden's permanent residents, sleeping or in stupors of various origin. Curled on their sides, knees drawn up, unopen to anything. In other words, huddled. From the great height of one of Arlington Street's office buildings, the forms look like things dumped onto the hillside from a great height. An overhead veteran to be apt to see a post-battle battlefield aspect to the array of forms. Except for the WYYY engineer, all the men are textured in urban scuzz, unshaven, yellow-fingered, and exposure-bronzed. They have coats and bedrolls for blankets, and old twine-handle shopping bags, and glad bags for recyclable cans and bottles. Also, huge camper's packs without any color to them. Their clothes and appurtenances are the same color as the men, in other words. A few have steel supermarket carts, filled with possessions and wedged by their owners' bodies against a downhill roll. One of the cart owners has vomited in his sleep, and the vomit has assumed a lava-like course toward the huddled form of another man curled just downhill. One of the shopping carts, from upscale Bread and Circus, has an ingeniously convenient little calculator on its handlebar, designed to let shoppers subtotal their groceries as they select them. The men have sepia nails, and all somehow look toothless, whether they have teeth or not. Every so often a frisbee lands among them. The loose ball makes a beanbaggy sound against players' feet above and behind them. Two skinny and knit-capped boys descend very close to the engineer, chanting very softly, "Smoke?" ignoring all the other forms, which anyone could tell are undercapitalized, for purchasing smoke. When his eyes are open, he's the only one on the hillside to see the round bellies of ascending ducks pass low overhead, catching a thermal off the hillside and rising to wheel away left, due south. His WYYY-109 t-shirt and inhaler and glasses and M-Fizzy and spine-split copy of Metallurgy of Annular Isotopes are just off the edge of the reflecting blanket. His torso is pale and ribby, his chest covered with tough little buttons of acne scar. The hillside's grass is still pretty viable. One or two of the scattered fetal forms have black cans of burnt-out sterno beside them. Bits of the hillside are reflected in Arlington storefronts and office windows and the glass of passing cars. An unexceptional white Dodge or Chevy-type van pulls out of Arlington's traffic and does some pretty impressive parallel parking along the curb at the hillside's bottom. A man in an ancient NATO surplus wool greatcoat is up on his hands and knees to the engineer's lower left, throwing up. Bits of chyme hang from his mouth and refuse to detach. There's little bloody threads in it. His hunched form looks somehow canine on the uneven slope. The fetal figure wedged unconscious under the front wheels of the shopping cart nearest the engineer has only one shoe, and that shoe's without laces. The exposed sock is ash-colored. Besides the handicapped license plate, the only exceptional things about the van, now idling at the curb far below, are the tinted windows and the fact that the van is spotless and twinkly with wax to about halfway up its paneled side. But above that line, dirty and rust-saucered and shamefully neglected-looking. The engineer has been turning his head this way and that, trying to tan evenly along his whole jawline. The curbside van idles at a distant little point between his heels. Some of the hillside's forms have curled themselves around bottles and pipes. A smell comes off them, rich and agricultural. The student engineer doesn't usually try to sun and chap his skin at the same time, but chapping ops have lately been scarce, since Madame Psychosis of 60 minutes more or less took her sudden leave of medical absence. The student engineer hasn't once had the heart to set out on the union's convoluted roof and monitor the substitute shows. The engineer moves his upturned face back and forth. First, Madam was replaced by a mass comm graduate student who proved a crushing disappointment as a misdiagnosis. Then Madam was publicly deemed irreplaceable by management, and the engineer was now paid simply to cue her background music and then sit monitoring a live mic for a noiseless 60 minutes, which means he has to stay in his booth maintaining zero levels with a live mic and can't ascend with his receiver and cigarettes, even if he wanted to. The station's student manager's given the engineer written instructions on just what to say when people phone in during the hour to inquire and wish Psychosis a speedy recovery from whatever might ail her. At once denying and encouraging rumors of suicide, institutionalization, spiritual crisis, silent retreat, pilgrimage to the snow-capped east. The disappearance of someone who's been only a voice is somehow worse instead of better. A terrible silence now, weeknights. A different silence altogether from the radio silence-type silence that used to take up over half her nightly show. Silence of presence versus silence of absence, maybe. The silences on the tapes are the worst. Some listeners have actually come in and down through the deep cortex and into the cold pink studio itself to inquire. Some to allay this firm conviction that Madame was still showing up and sitting there, by the mic, not saying anything. Another of the men sleeping nearby keeps punching at the air in his sleep. Almost all the personal wee-hour inquiries were from listeners somehow bent, misshapen, speech-defective, vacantly grinning, damaged in some way. The type whose spectacles have been repaired with electrician's tape. Shyly inquiring, apologies for bothering someone they can clearly see is not even there. Before the student manager's written instructions, the student engineer wordlessly directed their attention to Madam's triptych screen with no silhouette behind it. Another white Dodge van, just as unevenly clean and opaque windowed, has appeared on the ridge above and behind the hillside's littered forms. It casts no visible shadow. A frisbee ring caroms off the clean grill of its snout. It idles, its panel door facing the declivity and the other white van's panel door far below. One hideous little inquirer had a hat with a lens on it and seemed about to fall forward into the engineer's lap, his attendant wanting some address where they might send something supportive and floral. The NASA blanket's micronized aluminoid coating is designed to refract every possible UV ray into the student engineer's bare skin. The engineer knows about the ambulance and the Brigham and women's ICU and five-day rehab ward from the thick, swart girl Notkin, the one with the disreputable hat and film department ID, who came down via the Basilar elevator late at night to retrieve some old tapes of the program for the madam's personal listening use, she said, and was fortunate enough to know the madam in private life, she said. The term is treatment. Madam Psychosis is in long-term treatment at something the bearded girl in the sooty hat obliquely described as only half a house in some unbelievably unpleasant and low-rent part of the metro area. This is the precise total of what the WYYY engineer knows. He is shortly to have occasion to wish he knew a great deal more, which see the dimpled steel ramp now protruding from the squeakily opened panel door of the van on the ridge above and behind him, which see the utter darkness inside the idling van down along the Arlington Street curb, whose side panels also been slid open from within. The southwest hillside is copless. The garden's platoon of MDC finest are all in their souped-up golf carts over at the drained pond, throwing curved sections of glazed donut into the ducks' shrubbery and telling a largely dispersed already crowd to please move along. The ridge's frisbees and hacky sackers have abruptly vanished. There's now an eerie stillness like a reef when a shark cruises through. The ridge's van's idling maw, open and black, silver-tongued. Which see also the wheelchair that now all of a sudden shoots down the hillside's van's ramp as a madly squeaking brass-colored blur, a snowplow-like scoop-type thing welded to it, and out front, skimming the ground and throwing off chaff from the swath of grass it's mowing, moving terrifically fast, brakes unapplied, the legless figure up on burly stumps in the chair, fleur-de-lis with sword stem masked and bent far forward for a skier's pure speed, the huddled, fetal hillside figures, the speeding chair slaloms, the dim, glittered movements of arrangement for reception deep within the curbside van way at the bottom of the steep grade. The engineer arching his neck way out to capture sun on the scarred hollows under his jaw. The shopping cart with the calculator clipped by a squeaking rubberized wheel at an angle and sent clattering off down the hillside, spraying possessions, the homeless shoe to which it had been roped, skittering empty behind it, and the cart's now shoeless, unconscious owner just waving at the air in front of his face in sleep, as if at a bad DT dream of lost shoe and worldly goods. The calculating cart, whumping into the side of the hunched man vomiting and flipping over and bouncing several times, and the vomiting man rolling and yelping, vulgarities echoing. The WYYY engineer now to be seen hiking himself up on a chill-reddened elbow with a start, and starting to turn and look above and behind him up at the ridge, just as the speeding wheelchair with a hunched figure reaches him and the chair's shovel scoops the engineer and his NASA blanket and shirt and book up, and runs over the glasses and bottle of M-Fizzy with one wheel, and bears the engineer in the scoop up and away and down the steep grade toward the idling van at the bottom, a van whose own angled ramp now slides out like a tongue or autoteller's transaction receipt, the NASA blanket blowing away from the scooped engineer's flailing form about halfway down, and suddenly aloft in a hillside thermal and blown far out over Arlington Street traffic by the keen November wind. The madly squeaking wheelchair aloft over hillside moguls and coming back down and up again. The snatched engineer in the chair's scoop appearing to the hillside's roused figures mostly as an hallucinatory waggle of bare limbs and strangely wheezy shrieks for help, or at least a look out below. All as the modified chair squeaks frantically straight down the hillside's most efficient downward line toward the van with the ramp now idling in gear, its pipes exhaust beating the street in high RPM idle, the NASA blanket twisting, coruscant in the air high above the street, and the shriek-roused figures on the hillside lying there still bent in and barely moving, stiff with cold and general woe, except for the hunched man, the unwell man, who'd been hit by the dislodged cart, who's rolled to a stop and is thrashing, holding the parts that were hit. The 11th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. 18:10 hours. 133 kids and 13 assorted staff sitting down at supper time. The ETA dining hall taking most of the first floor of West House, a sort of airy, atrium-like commons, broad and knotty pine-paneled, the east wall hugely fenestrated, and columns running the length of the room at center, with ceiling fans high overhead circulating the rich and slightly sour smell of bulk-prepared food, the oceanic sound of 20 different tables' conversation, the flat clink of utensils on plates, much chewing, the clank and tinkle of the dishwasher's conveyor belt behind the tray bus window with its sign saying, "Your mother does not live here. Bush your tray." The muffled shouts of kitchen workers in steam. The top upperclassmen get the best table, an unspoken tradition. The one nearest the gas fireplace in winter, and the AC venting in July. The one whose chair's legs are all pretty much even, both seats and backs, with thin corduroy cushions in ETA red and gray. The prorectors have their own permanent table near the carbs bar, the Syrian satelliter, an enormous peasant-skirted moment soft profiler, are with them. The players can all do some very serious eating. Some of them still in sweaty sweats, with salt-stiff hair, too hungry after 3 set PMs to shower before refueling. Co-ed tables are quietly discouraged. The boys' 18s and the cream of the 16s are all at the best table. Ortho, the darkness Stice, ETA's 16s A1, has just this PM gone 3 sets with Hal and Condensa, 17, ETA's second-best overall boy, taking Hal all the way to 7-5 in the third in an off-record, non-challenge, exhibition-ish engagement Stitt had them play out on the West Courts that afternoon for reasons no one has yet pinned down. The match's audience had grown steadily as other challenges got done and people came up from the weight room and showers. News that Stice had very nearly beaten an ink nobody but John Wayne has been able to beat has made its figure eight way around the tables and serving line and salad bar. And lots of younger kids keep looking at the best table, and Stice, 16, crew-cutted, and still in his black Fila sweats with no shirt under the unzipped top, assembling a complex sandwich on his plate. And they let their eyes widen and postures sag to communicate awe. R-H-I-P. Stice, oblivious, bites into a sandwich like it's the wrist of an assailant. The only sound at the table for the first few minutes is a fork work and mastication and the slight gasping sounds of people trying to breathe while they eat. You rarely speak for the first few minutes here, eating. Supper is deadly serious. Some of the kids even start in on their trays while still in line at the milk dispenser. Now, Coyle bites in. Wayne has made his entree into a sandwich and lowers and bites. Keith Freer's eyes are half-closed as his jaw muscles bulge and slacken. Some of the players' inclined heads are hard to see over the height of their food. Struck and shocked, side by side, bite in sync and chew. The only one at the table not eating like a refugee is Trevor Axford, who, as a small child back in Short Beach, Connecticut, once fell off his bike onto his head and received a tiny lesion-type brain injury, after which all food, everywhere, tastes horrible to him. His clearest explanation of the way food tastes to him is that it tastes the way vomit smells. He's discouraged from speaking at meals, and holds his nose while he eats, and eats with the neutral, joyless expression of somebody dispensing fuel into his car. Hal and Condenza dismantles the Stelliform mold shape, ETA mashed potatoes come in, mixing baby boils in with the mashed. Petropolis Khan and Elliot Cornspan eat with such horrible POW-ish gusto that nobody else will sit with them. They're by themselves at a small table behind Shocked and Struck, utensils glittering amid a kind of fine mist or spray. Jim Trolch keeps holding a clear tumbler of milk up to the ceiling's full spectrum lights and swirling the milk around in the light, looking at it. Pemulous chews with his mouth open, producing moist noises, a habit so family of origin ingrained no amount of peer pressure can break him of it. Eventually the darkness clears his throat to speak. In the showers he'd gotten up to the middle of an Xmas story about one of his parents' epic rows. His parents had met and fallen in love in a country western bar in Partridge, Kansas, just outside Liberal, Kansas, on the Oklahoma border. Met and fallen in star-crossed love in a bar playing this popular Kansas country western bar game, where they put their bare forearms together and laid a lit cigarette in the little valley between the two forearms' flesh and kept it there till one of them finally jerked their arm away and reeled away holding their arm. Mr. and Mrs. Stice each discovered somebody else that wouldn't jerk away and reel away, Stice explained. Their forearms were still, to this day, covered with little white slugs of burn scar. They toppled like pines for each other from the get-go, Stice explained. They'd been divorced and remarried 4 or 5 times, depending on how you define certain jurisprudential precepts. When they were on good domestic terms, they stayed in their bedroom for days of squeaking springs with the door locked, except for brief sallies out for beef-eater gin and Chinese takeout and little white cardboard pails with wire handles, with the Stice children wandering, ghost-like, through the clapboard house in sagging diapers or woolen underwear, subsisting on potato chips out of econo bags bigger than most of them were, the Stice kids. The kids did somewhat physically better during periods of nuptial strife, when a stony-faced Mr. Stice slammed the kitchen door and went off daily to sell crop insurance, while Mrs. Stice, whom both Mr. Stice and the darkness called the bride, while the bride spent all day and evening cooking intricate, multi-course meals, she'd feed bits of to the brood. Stice refers to both himself and his 6 siblings as the brood, and then keep warm in quietly rattling lidded pots, and then hurl at the kitchen walls when Mr. Stice came home smelling of gin and of cigarette brands and toilet O, not the bride's own. Ortho Stice loves his folks to distraction, but not blindly, and every holiday home to Partridge, Kansas. He memorizes highlights of their connubial battles so he can regale the ETA upperclassmen with them, mostly at meals, after the initial forkwork and gasping have died down, and people have returned to sufficient levels of blood sugar and awareness of their surroundings to be regaled. Some of them listen, drifting in and out. Trolch and Pemulis are arguing about whether ETA's kitchen staff has started trying to slip them powdered milk on the sly. Freer and Wayne are still hunched and chewing, very intent. Hal's making some sort of structure out of his food. Struck keeps both elbows on the table at all times and utensils in his clenched fists like a parody of a man eating. Pemulis always listens to Stice's tales, often repeating little phrases, shaking his head in admiration. I'm just going to go up and refuse to eat one more thing with the utensil that's gone down the disposal. Shocked is holding up a fork with crazy tines. Just look at it. Who could eat with something like that? The old man is a son of a bitch that is cool under fire in terms of the bride, Stice says, leaning in to bite and chew. The tendency at ETA is to take the entree and, unless it's a wet entree, to take wheat bread and make it a sandwich for the extra carbs. It's like Pemulus can't really taste his food unless he mashes it against his palate. The Academy sweetbread is bicycled in by guys in Birkenstock sandals from Bread and Circus Quality Provisions in Cambridge. Because it's got to be not only sugarless, but low in glutens, which Tavis and Stitt believe promote torpor and excess mucus. Axford, who lost to tall Paul Shaw in straight sets, and if he loses to him again tomorrow goes down to number 5A, stares stonily into space. His motion's less like somebody eating than like somebody miming eating. Hal's made an intricate fortification structure of his food, complete with turrets and archer slits, and even though he's not much eating or drinking his 6 cranberry juices, he keeps swallowing a lot, studying his structure. As the eating slows down at the best table, the more observant of them give Hal and Axford tiny sideways looks. The players' different CPUs humming through decision trees on whether a still publicly undiscussed but much rumored showdown with Dr. Tavis and the ONANTA urology guy, plus now this loss to Shaw and near loss to Orthostice, might not have shaken ink and axe handle along some psychic competitive fault line. Different guys with different rankings calculating the permuted advantages to themselves of Hal and Axford having a deeply distracted and anxious week. Though Michael Pemulus, the other rumored ONANTA urine scannee, ignores Axford's expression and Hal's excessive swallowing altogether, though possibly studiously ignoring them, staring meditatively at the squeegees taken down off the wall,
259,
and leaning against the unlit fireplace, fingers steepled before his lips, hearing out Trulch, who blows his nose with one hand and rattles his tumbler of half-drunk milk on the tabletop with the other. Pemulus shakes his head very seriously at Trulch. Not a chance, brother.
I'm telling you, man, this milk is powdered.
Trulch peering down into the tumbler, probing the milk's surface with a thick finger.
Me? I can tell from powdered. I have growing up domestic confirmed traumas around powdered. The day Mother announced milk was too heavy to keep lugging back from the store and switched to powdered with Father's okay. Father knuckling under like Roosevelt at Yalta. My big sister ran away from home, and the rest of us were traumatized around it, this switch to powdered, which is unmistakable if you know what to look for.
Freer makes a snoring noise.
And do I ever know what to look for, to verify?
Trulch is hoarse, and one of these people who speaks to more than one person at once by looking from one person to one person to one person. He's not a born public speaker.
Namely, your telltale residues along the sides of the glass when swished.
With great flourished swishings of the milk.
Except, Trulch, you can turn around and see them fucking loading the bags into the dispenser every 20 minutes. Bags of milk. That say milk on them, the bags. Liquid, sloshy, hard to handle. It's milk. You see bags, you see the word milk. They're counting on the packaging. Image management. Sensory management.
Responding to Pemulus, but looking at Struck.
Part of some larger overall kertwang. Possible punishment for the eschaton thing.
Eyes going briefly to Hal.
Covert vitamins possibly next. Let's not even mention saltpeter. Put aside deductions from bags a second. I'm sticking to facts. Fact, this is verifiably powdered milk.
You're saying they mix powdered milk and then try and pour it into milk bags all to allay?
Shocked clears his mouth and swallows mightily.
Tavis can't even regrout tile in the locker room without calling a community meeting or appointing a committee. The regrouting committee's been dragging along since May. Suddenly they're pulling secret 0300 milk switches? It doesn't ring true, Jim.
And Trulch has a cold, he said. Freer observes, indicating the little bottle of Seldane next to Trolch's squeezing bowl by his plate.
You can't even taste, Trolch, if you got a real cold.
Trevor should have the cold, Axe handled, no?
Shocked says, tapping carminative capsules into his palm from his own amber bottle. With supper, they can choose milk or else cranberry juice, that most carb-caloric of juices, which froths readily in its own clear dispenser by the salad bar. The milk dispenser stands alone against the west wall, a big, huge, 24-liter three-bagger, the milk inserted in ovaloid mammarial bags into its refrigerated cabinet of brushed steel, with three receptacles for tumblers and three levers for controlled dispensing. There's two levers for skim, and one for, supposedly, high lecithin chocolate skim, which every new ETA tries exactly once and discovers tastes like skim with a brown crayon melted into it. There's a sign in a kitchen staffer's crude black block caps, taped to the dispenser's facade, that says, "Milk is filling, semicolon, drink what you take." The sign used to say, "Milk is filling, comma, drink what you take," until the comma was semicolonized by the insertion of a blue dot by a fairly obvious person.
260.
The line for seconds on entrees now stretches out past the milk dispenser. The best thing about satiation and slowing down on the eating is leaning back and feeling autolysis start in on what you ate, and tending to your teeth while you gaze around the airy room at crowds and clumps of kids, observing behaviors and pathologies with a clear and sated head. The littler kids running in tight circles trying to follow the shadow of the ceiling fan. Girls laughing, crumpled against their seatmates' shoulders. People protecting their plates. The blurred sexuality and indecisive postures of puberty. Two marginal male 16s have their heads directly in the bowls in the salad bar. And some of the surrounding females are commenting. Different kids are illustrating points with different gestures. John Wayne and Keith Freer stroll purposefully through the serpentine crowd and up to the front of the seconds line, and insert themselves in front of a little boy who's tearing at a held bagel with great violent movements of head and neck. The 18 A's get free Budinskis. R-H-I, literal P, at ETA. Jim Strzok spears one of the cherry tomatoes out of Hal's salad bowl with a savage fork gesture. Hal makes no comment. Trolch has run his thick finger around the inside of the tumbler and is holding the digit out at different guys around the table.
Note the certain bluish cast to it. Traces and remains. Suspicious foam. Minute grains of not quite altogether dissolved particulate powdered stuff. Powdered always leaves its telltale signs.
Your fucking head is a minute grain, Trolch.
Put that finger away. Trying to eat here.
Paranoia, Pemula says, scooping up stray peas with the flat of his knife.
Base tuition of 21,700 scooters, not counting, Trolch says, moving the finger back and forth in the air.
The stuff drying on the finger does not, admittedly, exactly look appetite-whetting.
And yet let's note how the lungs not up, in spite of rampant weather and Achilles complaints. And today's lunch, a total deja vu of yesterday's lunch. And the bread and bagels they've started getting us day old with the yellow stickers on the bags. And there's dinette sets in the tunnels and acoustic tiles in the halls and lawnmowers in the kitchen and tripods in the grass and squeegees on the wall. And Stice's bed moves around. And there's a ball machine in the girls' lockers, Longley reports, that for this kind of tuition, none of this stuff, the staff can get around to cleaning up before...
Stice's head has jerked up, a trace of mashed potato on his nose.
Who says my bed moves?
How's it you know anything about any beds moving?
But it's true.
The husky six tripod of Mario's near fatal encounter with the USS Millicent Kent was only the beginning. Starting with the mysterious and continuing fall of acoustic ceiling tiles from their places in the sub-dorm's drop ceilings, inanimate objects have either been moved into or just out of nowhere, appearing in wildly inappropriate places around ETA, for the past couple months, in a steadily accelerating and troubling cycle. Last week, a grounds crew lawnmower, sitting clean and silent and somehow menacing in the middle of the dawn kitchen, gave Mrs. Clark the fantods, and resulted in eggplant parmesan for two suppers in a row, which sent shockwaves. Yesterday a.m. there'd been a canonesque ball machine, no small feat to move around anywhere or get through doors, in the female sauna, which machine some of the upper-class girls had found and screamed at when they went in for the dawn saunas that help alleviate some vague female-type problem that none of the guys quite fathom. And two black girls on the breakfast crew reportedly found a set of squeegees on the dining hall's north wall, several meters up and hung, crossed in a kind of saltire, placed there by parties unknown. FDV Hardy's AM groundsman reportedly took the things down, and now they're leaning by the fireplace. The inappropriate found objects have had a tectitic and sinister aspect. None of the cheery odor of regular pranksterism. They're not funny. To varying degrees, they've given everyone the fantods. Mrs. Clark had taken the morning off again, was why the repeat lunch. Stice's eyes are back on his plate, which is nearly clean. Unmentioned is the fact that shocked, and tall Paul Shaw, at lunch, went over the whole part of the north wall the black girls said they found the squeegees on, and could find neither nails nor holes from nails, as in no visible means of attachment. The whole thing's been studiously not talked about, adding to everybody's discomfort at Trolch's hoarse complaints about tuition, which vary in specifics but are otherwise routine. And then now, the ultimate dietary clusterfuck. Attempted powdered milk.
Trying to foist it, you're saying?
I'm saying, and look at us, and what do?
Fake a cold and stay in bed playing sportscaster with a TP in protest?
Says Pemulus. Trolch uses the bottle of Seldane to point for emphasis. We don't want to hear about it. We look the other way with our heads in the sand.
Sounds fucking painful. Go find some fucking synonyms for beat.
Stice swallows hugely.
Never open your eyes underground, my old man's dictum.
And so we distract ourselves, Trolch says. We yuck it up.
Pemulus makes a K sound. Here's the real question. How dumb is Trolch?
Trolch is so dumb he thinks a manila folder's a Filipino contortionist.
Trolch, who's buried in Grant's tomb?
Kyle Coyle says surely they've all heard the one about what the Canadian girls put behind their ears to attract boys. John Wayne gives him not a look. Wayne's peering inside his own tumbler, where there does seem to be some sort of residue. There are fragments of lettuce in his eyelashes. Orthostice's cheeks are ballooned with food. His eyes on his own salad remains, expression abstract and furrowed. A terrible kind of community energy in the whole dining hall, a kind of anxious sound carpet under the surf of voices and the tinkle of flatware. And the darkness is at some vague center of this energy, somehow, you can feel. Neither Wayne nor Hal's been approachable all fall on court. Kids at other tables say low-toned things to their seatmates, and then the seatmate looks covertly over at Stice's table. Forehead purply crumpled, Stice stares hard at his salad and tries to block input from his phenomenal peripheral vision. Two 14s are contending over toast. Petropolis Khan is preparing to catapult a chickpea at somebody. Jim Strzok points out Bridget Boone and the USS Millicent Kent returning for what Strzok counts as fourths, and Stice blocks the side out. The sad, pretty sunset out over the hilltops of Newton cannot be seen because the room's big windows face east, out over the hillside and the Enfield Marine Complex that the Academy is bathed in shadow. So EM's porch lights are already on, and tall cubist bits of the old metropolis beyond that, east, with shadows encroaching. The afternoon just past was a glory, scrubbed and cool and windless, cloud-free, the sun a disk, the sky a dome, soaked in light, even the northern horizons bell clear against a faint green-yellow cast. Schacht has about 8 amber bottles of various medicines for his Crohn's disease and a whole ritual of administration. A couple of the black girls who work kitchen and custodial day shifts can be seen against the shadowy tree line, making their way down the steep hillside's unauthorized path back down to the halfway house thing for wretched people who come up here to work short time. The girls' bright, cheap jackets are vivid in the shadow and trees tangle. The girls are having to hold hands against the grade, walking sideways and digging heavily in at each step. The black girl Clinette, Hallid read fear in as she left CT's office with his litter, now has a bulging backpack on her back. As in bulging maybe with dumpster pilferage?
261.
Her arms strung way out between the other black girl, Dee Dee, and the trees she grabs, and digging in sideways with each step. The hesitancy of steep, dark slopes, rooty, and shot through with briars. A girl with bangs rises and tings her tumbler with a spoon to make an announcement. Nobody pays attention. Now cons by custom allowed to come over and sit with them at the best table, post-prandially. Wayne and Stice both shiver at the same time as the overhead lighting suddenly becomes the big room's primary light. There's a brief and sort of ignorant discussion on why girls who hit backhands one-handed seem prone to have different sized breasts. Hal recalls his brother's late-in-college thing of seeing if he could take a girl out somewhere public and then meet and have covert sex with a whole different girl while still out with the first girl. This was after the girl Oren had been wildly in love with and himself had compulsively used in films had been disfigured. Oren kept a record of subjects that was sort of a cross between a chart and a journal. He used to come home and leave it out just pleading to be read. This was back when his brother Oren needed only to have sexual intercourse with them instead of getting them to fall so terribly in love with him they'd never be able to want anyone else. He'd taken obscure massage and psych courses and read tantric books whose illustrations seemed about as sexy to Hal as Twister. Coyle says, "Their ankles." Everybody ignores him. Wayne's already left the table. Little 14C, Bernard McCulloch, two tables over from the milk dispenser and constitutionally delicate and not long for ETA, throws up in a silky tan cataract onto the floor by his chair. And there is the shriek of the feet of other chairs being scooted in a star pattern away from the table and the protracted vowels of repulsed children. Struck, pemulous, shocked, and freer, have all had sexual intercourse. Coyle's a probable, but reticent. Axford has trouble even publicly showering, much less submitting nude to a female's inspection. Hal is maybe the one male ETA for whom lifetime virginity is a conscious goal. He sort of feels like O's having enough acrobatic coitus for all three of them. Freer even has a, like, souvenir culposcope bolted to the inside of his locker door, where a pinup'd have been in days of yore. And Pemulus and Struck have allegedly patronized the combat zone after the fiscally pressed city buckled and rehung the combat zone's red lights east of the common. But Jim Trolch and sex? No way. And with Wayne and Stice, the question seems somehow beside the point. Hal's mouth feels like it's overflowing with spit. He should, by all rights, have lost to Stice today, and he knows it. Stice was in physical control of the third set. Stice choked it away, only because he didn't believe he could beat Hal yet, deep down, since Hal's competitive explosion. But the crisis of faith that cost Stice the match had concerned a different Hal. Hal can tell. It's not a whole new Hal, a Hal who does not get high or hide, a Hal who in 29 days is going to hand his own personal urine over to authority figures with a wide smile, an exemplary posture, and not a secretive thought in his head. No one except Pemulus and Axford know it's a whole new and chemical-free Hal who should by all rights have lost to a 16-year-old out there in public on what ended up a gorgeous New England autumn day. Wayne had gotten up and bust his tray in the middle of the jejune breast thing. Ortho the darkness, Stice is still staring into his salad. If you could open Stice's head, you'd see a wheel inside another wheel, gears and cogs being widgeted into place. Stice has a secret suspicion about a secret that has more to do with the actual table than with the people at the table. A lot of the guys interpret his intense distraction as Stice's still being in the magic can't-miss zone from this PM's match. The idea being that Nook girls can only attract guys by being really easy to X is the joke, Coyle says into the noise. Then there's a brief rippling lull in the whole dining hall as little Evan Ingersoll emerges from the entree lines and on crutches, his cast new and sailor hat white, unsigned, Prorector Tony Nwangi behind him with his hatchet face stony, carrying the kid's tray for him. The hall's unease is almost visible. A corona around Ingersoll and the ruptured patellar tendon that'll cost him at least 6 months of competitive development. Penn, whose femoral fracture will cost him a year, isn't even back yet from St. E's Orthopedic. But at least Ingersoll's back. Hal gets up to go over, Trulch rising to accompany him after a long look at Trevor Axford, Ingersoll's BB of record, who's sitting in his chair with his eyes shut tight, unable to make any sort of conciliatory gesture. A match sore Hal, not limping, but stiff-legged and shoulders slightly rolling, as he and Trulch move serpentine around tables, steering way clear of the custodian and dull steel bucket on rollers, and the mop spreading and diluting McCulloch's chyme out in a thinning circle that clears three tables, which Hal and Trulch avoid with practiced curves around tables whose layout they all know well. Hal to say, "Hey," and "How's the limb?" Trulch to say, "Hey," and be basically relieved he's away from a discussion of females as sexual objects. Trulch has never come close to even dating anybody. Some guys here never do. It's the same at all the academies, this asexual contingent. Some junior players don't have the emotional juice left over after tennis to face what dating requires. Bold, nerveless guys on the court who go slack and pale at the thought of approaching a female in any social context. Certain things not only can't be taught, but can be retarded by other stuff that can be taught. The whole Tavis shtit program here is supposedly a progression toward self-forgetting. Some find the whole girl issue thing brings them face to face with something in themselves they need to believe they've left far behind in order to hang in and develop. Trulch, Shaw, Axford. Any sort of sexual tension makes them feel like they need more oxygen than is available right then. A couple of the girls at ETA are kind of slutty, and some of the more aggressive, freer type guys can break some of the girls down and get them to have sex. There's nothing if not time and proximity here. But ETA is mostly a comparatively unsexual place. Maybe almost surprisingly so, considering the constant roar and gurgle here of adolescent glands, the emphasis on physicality, the fears of mediocrity, the back-and-forth struggles with ego, the loneliness and close proximity. There's scattered homosexuality, much of it emotional and unconsummated. Keith Freer's pet theory is that the bulk of ETA females are nascent lesbians who don't know it yet. That like any serious female athletes, they're basically vigorously male inside, and so sapphic-tending. The ones that get to the WTA show will probably be the ones
262
who find out that they are, he believes. Dykes, that is. The rest will marry and spend a lifetime by the club pool wondering why the hair on their husbands' backs makes them shudder. For example, the USS Millicent Kent, 16 and phenomenal on the incline bench press, with breasts like artillery and a butt like two bulldogs in a bag, Stice's term, which caught on, already looks like a penal matron, Freer likes to observe. And no one likes the fact that Carol Spodek's carried and prized the same single large grip Donny stick for going on 5 straight years. Ortho Stice of Southwest Kansas looks briefly up at Hal and Trulch's departure before returning his attention to a certain cherry tomato, perched somehow halfway up the shallow incline of his salad bowl. It's possible that the cherry tomato is attached halfway up the incline by an adhesive bit of yogurt dressing, rather than just sitting there defying gravity on its own. Stice doesn't use a finger to move the tomato, and check this. He's using only his concentrated will. He's trying to will the cherry tomato to roll of its own objectile power down the incline and into the bowl's center. He stares at the cherry tomato with enormous concentration, chewing his tri-level, skinless chicken filet sandwich. The chewing makes overlapping plates of muscle all the way up one side of his face and crew-cut scalp bulge and roll. He's trying to flex some kind of psychic muscle he's not sure he even has. The crew-cut lends his head an anvil-like aspect. Complete concentration makes his round, red, fleshy face look crumpled. Stice is one of those athletes whose body, you know, is an unearned divine gift because its conjunction with his face is so incongruous. He resembles a poorly spliced photo, some superhuman cardboard persona with a hole for your human face. A beautiful sports body, lithe and tapered and sleekly muscled, smooth, like a Polycletus body, Hermes or Theseus before his trials, on whose graceful neck sits the face of a ravaged Winston Churchill, broad and slab-featured, swart, fleshy, large-pored, with a mottled forehead, under the crew-cut's V-shaped hairline, and eye pouches, and jowls that hang and, whenever he moves suddenly or lithely, make a sort of meaty staccato sound like a wet dog shaking itself dry. Tony Nwangi is saying something acerbic to Hal, who looks like he's kneeling penitent before Ingersoll. Everyone at the surrounding tables inclined very subtly away from Hal. Trolch is signing Ingersoll's cast as he speaks into his fist. Off the court, Ortho Stice's flat-top crew-cut and penchant for cuff-rolled blue jeans and button-down short sleeves with a checkered pattern are strictly from Hick. The facial scrunching that attends concentration adds crevices and seams and an uneven flush to the bulldog face. His cheeks are ballooned with food as he stares at the perched cherry tomato, trying to respect this object with all his might. Summoning the sort of coercive reverence he'd felt this PM, as several balls' sudden, anomalous swerves against wind and their own vectors half convinced Stice they'd become sensitive to his inner will at crucial times. He'd mishit one cross-court volley and seen the thing head for an area wide, even of the doubles' sideline, and then curve like a drenched spitter back to land just inside the singles corner. And this at a time when the ground's pines behind Hal and Condensa were breeze-leaning in the exact opposite direction. Hal had given Stice a little bit of a look on that one. Stice couldn't finally tell whether Hal noticed anything amiss in the mysterious curves and downdrafts that seemed to favor the darkness alone. Hal had played with the wide-eyed but unfocused look of a tennis player right on the verge of falling apart out there, and yet strangely effectless, as if deep inside some well of his own private troubles. And Stice wills himself again not to wonder what had passed with the headmaster and the ONANTA urologist whose lab-equipped van's unscheduled appearance in the ETA parking lot yesterday afternoon had caused a tsunami of panic just before supper, especially since Pemulus and his supply of lab-ready Visine bottles were nowhere to be found. Even among the small circle who know Hal gets secretly high, it doesn't make much sense that Hal's misery'd be Tavis or urine-related, since Pemulus has never seemed blither than today. And if anyone were going to get the boot, chemically or otherwise, it was not going to be the ETA administration's relative and second-best boy. Hal and his brother Mario both know that the skim milk at ETA has been premixed powdered milk since Charles Tavis assumed the helm 4 years back and told Mrs. Clark he wanted the kids' animal fat intake halved in a month by any and all means. The kitchen's graveyard shift power mixes it in enormous steel bowls and then strains out the foam and pours the milk into real milk dispenser bags for a kind of placebo effect. It's mostly just the concept of powdered milk that gags people. Struck has traded his shiny clean plate for the absent Incandenza's fortification-structured plate of uneaten fillets, low-gluten bread, cornbread, baby boils, a chickpea pea-based ola, half a fresh squash, mashed potatoes packed in a stelliform gelatin mold, and a shallow bowl of dessert semis, featuring mostly, it seemed, like prunes. Hal is still down on one knee by Ingersoll's chair, his elbows on his knee, listening across Ingersoll and a blindfolded Idris Arslanian to Tony Nwangi. Keith Freer remarks blandly on how Hal seems like he's feeling sort of punk this evening, checking Stice for a reaction. Struck utters truisms about wasting food and global hunger through a full mouth. Struck is wearing a sox cap to the side so the bill shadows half his face. The bread is unkind to his braces. Freer is wearing the leather vest with no shirt under, which is what he favors after weights have pumped his torso full of air. Stice had had a traumatic psychic experience at 14 when he'd set the weight on the pull-down station too high, and Dr. Dolores Rusk has authorized his exemption from all but very basic weights, pending resolution of his fear of weights. The joke around ETA is that Stice, who's surely showbound after graduation, has no fear of heights, but does fear weights. Keith Freer, though kind of a second-rank junior player, does look beautiful in his calfskin vest. His face and body match. Trolch wants a sports casting career, but Freer is the ETA with looks Interlace would favor. Freer's from inland Maryland, originally. His family's riches nouveau. A family Amway business that hit big in the BS-90s with his now-deceased father's invention of a pet rockish novelty that was ubiquitous in stockings for two straight pre-millennial Xmases, the so-called phoneless cord. Stice dimly recalls his old man getting a phoneless cord in his stocking, ostentatiously packaged on Ortho's first recallable Xmas back in Partridge, Kansas. The old man cocking an eyebrow, and the bride laughing and slapping her big knee. Nobody now much even gets the remembered gag, though. So few things needing cords anymore. But Freer's old man had invested his windfall shrewdly. The 1st of May, YDAU, outcropping northwest of Tucson, Arizona, USA.
"My own father," Steepley said.
Steepley again faced outward, one hip out, and a hand on that hip. The scratch on his triceps was now ugly and puffed. Also, an area of Steepley's left finger is whiter than the skin around it. The removal of a university ring, or more probably, a wedding band. It seemed curious to Marat that Steepley would undergo electrolysis but not take trouble to fix his finger's annular pallor.
Steepley said, "My own father, sometime around midlife. We watched him get consumed with a sort of entertainment. It wasn't pretty. I was never sure how it started or what it was about."
"You are now importing a personal anecdote of you," Marat stated.
Steepley did not shrug. He was pretending to study something particular out on the floor of the desert.
"But nothing like this sort of entertainment. A plain old television program.
Television of broadcasting and, how did one express it? The passivity?"
"Yes, broadcast television. The program in question was called MASH. The title was an acronym, not a command. As a boy, I can recall some confusion on this point."
"I am knowing of the USA historical broadcast television comedy program, MASH," Marat stated.
"The fucking thing ran forever, it seemed. The program that would not die. BS 70s and 80s before it finally died mercifully. Set in a military hospital during the UN's action on Korea."
Marat remained without expression.
"Police action."
Many small birds of the mountain of the outcropping had begun to whistle and twitter somewhere off above and behind them. Also maybe the tentative rattle of some serpent. Marat pretended to search for the watch in his pocket.
Steepley said, "Now, nothing prima facie exceptional about getting attached to a show. God knows I was attached to my share of shows. That's all it started as, an attachment or habit. Thursday nights at 2100 hours. 9 o'clock Eastern, 8 o'clock Central and Mountain. They used to broadcast this to alert you to when to watch or if you were going to tape it."
Marat watched the big man shrug from behind.
So the show was important to him. So, fine, okay. So he took pleasure in the program. God knows the guy was entitled. He'd worked like a dog his whole